Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome back to News and Views. I'm Rob Schofield. By any estimation, the news surrounding global climate change, what many scientists now characterize as the global climate emergency, continues to grow more dire. Recent reports indicate that we're now witnessing a raft of deeply worrisome consequences, including rapid decline in the polar ice caps, rising seas, and an increase in severe weather events. Of course, as much as we may be aware of this sobering news, it's sometimes difficult to understand the connections between such a massive global problem and what we're experiencing in our day-to-day lives, much less how we should respond and adapt. Thankfully, North Carolina maintains a state climate office to help us with these important tasks, and recently I got a chance to have an extended conversation with the scientist who heads up that effort, our state climatologist, Dr. Kathy Dello. Welcome to News and Views. It's good to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's obviously an incredibly challenging moment in the world of climate science and the response of humans to the challenges we face. Remind our listeners, though, a little bit about the climate office and why we have it here in North Carolina.
Yeah, so I am the director of the State Climate Office of North Carolina, and we are located at NC State University. People often think we're a state agency, but we are an independent science organization at the university. And we've been around now for 46 years, and most states have a state climate office and a state climatologist, which is the role I serve for North Carolina. And what we really are is the state's climate knowledge center. We gather data, we record our own data, we do original research, and all of it is driven by end users. So people who have questions or concerns about climate, we're not coming up with our own research agenda for science's sake.
I would imagine a lot of people have a lot of concerns, a lot of questions about climate right now. I'm probably one of them, and I guess it might be good to remind our listeners about sort of the difference between climate and weather. People sometimes get those concepts kind of mixed up.
Yeah, so the way I like to think of it, and this is my favorite analogy, all of us climatologists have our favorite climate and weather analogy, is that weather is your mood and climate's your personality. So kind of your longer term general outlook on life, maybe you're a really sunny, happy person most of the time. Your friends like being around you, but you can have some awful days. You're a human, and that's the weather. So what we see on the day-to-day basis, like today where I'm sitting in downtown Raleigh, it's raining. That's weather. But when we think about last year, and I know we're going to talk about this, 2020 was wet overall because of many days of weather that added up to be a wetter than average year.
So I was going to ask about 2020. Is that the main takeaway, that it was a warmer, wetter year here in North Carolina than we've had in a long time, or among the wetter and warmer?
Yeah, so it was our second wettest year on record. The wettest year on record was 2018, and we can remember that year because of Hurricane Florence. So it's pretty remarkable that we came very close to breaking that record without a big tropical event this year. And then it was also warm. So it was our third warmest year on record, and 2019 was our warmest year on record. But 2020, we saw both of them. We got warm and wet.
And it seems that we keep bumping up against this hard reality that we keep talking about 100-year floods and records that have been set over centuries, and they keep getting broken over periods of a couple of years. I mean, that would seem to pretty much indicate that we're in a period of significant change.
Yeah, so when we go back to that weather and climate analogy, we're really shifting our personality. That background state, that average, is shifting. So we're getting warmer, and when we talk about averages, we're talking about a degree or two, but mm-hmm. that really adds up when you look at those separate days of weather and extreme heat and nighttime heat. And the same with precipitation. So the 100-year flood is misleading because, like you said, we see many 100-year floods, sometimes within the same year and sometimes within the same areas frequently. So we know that North Carolina is getting wetter through extreme events, and we know that North Carolina is getting warmer mostly through nighttime temperatures.
I know y'all put out a climate science report. Is that the main takeaway, what we've just been discussing? Are there any other key findings?
Well, interestingly, the report came out on March 11th of 2020.
Oh, and sorry.
Many people remember that date. It was the day we went into lockdown. So a lot of news came at us very fast, including an assessment of North Carolina's climate. But yeah, that was one of the key takeaways. It's a wetter, hotter, more humid North Carolina. We're seeing impacts now through sea level rise and extreme precipitation. And then other things like daytime heat and humidity and incidences of diseases and stronger hurricanes will proliferate in the future.
And obviously those have big impacts across the spectrum on everything from agriculture to, I suppose, wildlife and people themselves and the places people inhabit, right? You can't find too many things that aren't impacted by these changes.
Exactly. So when you said up front, there's probably a lot of questions and climate concerns. Truly, my days are full with just a variety of different topics and meetings and impacts. Climate touches everything and everybody in this state. So all 10.5 million people are people that the office serves. And, you know, we can see things like global temperature records. So 2020 was the second warmest year on record globally, but really, we're feeling climate change and seeing climate change in our backyards and in our streets and on our coast here in North Carolina.
We're talking with Dr. Kathy Dello, who is the state climatologist for North Carolina. Kathy, the elephant in the room, the thing that has been debated ad nauseum for years now, but it seems as if we have finally reached the point where the number of naysayers is down to a very few. We know that the cause of this is CO2 pollution, right? Greenhouse gases are causing the planet to warm. That's the principal driving force behind these changes.
Yes, we know this. We've known this. This goes back to experiments in the 1800s. We're adding these heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere, and it warms. So a lot of the debate isn't necessarily on the science, but how we solve it or if we solve it.
Do you get still naysayers who maybe confront you at a presentation or send you emails that still attempt to deny the fact that CO2 pollution, carbon pollution, is causing climate change?
Absolutely, I do, but they've gone down in number. And I don't know if it's because before I was on the West Coast, and I don't know if people are more prone to sending emails there, but I also think it's become so obvious to many people that, you know, we talk to people in North Carolina after Hurricane Florence and after these few wet, hot years for saying, this used to not flood before, or it wasn't this hot before, and are seeing change and feeling their lived experiences through climate. And it's become almost inevitable that we're seeing change.
So there's obviously just a raft of things that we need to do in terms of responding, both in doing our best to make our lives sustainable and making human settlements sustainable in this new world, but also trying to do our best to reduce the carbon pollution so that we can at least not make the problem a whole lot worse. We've made some headway in that direction. North Carolina has developed some plans to move in that direction. We also see perhaps some hopeful signs on the global level. Talk to us about some of these things that we simply must do if we want to avoid just catastrophic change across the planet.
Yeah, so we know what we have to do. We have to cut our greenhouse gas emission. We know what's causing the problem. We talked about that. But we also have to consider adaptation and resilience, because the climate has changed and will change. And we've bought into a certain amount of warming and change here in North Carolina. But we know that cutting our greenhouse gas emissions is not just me and you or the city of Raleigh or the state of North Carolina. It's a global thing, because the atmosphere doesn't know the borders that we've put on the ground. We're all contributing to the problem. And those of us who are contributing to the problem the most are often not the people who are most affected by climate change. So there are huge environmental justice problems and climate justice problems at play. But there are some encouraging moves in the past few weeks. The U.S. has rejoined the Paris Agreement, which will be effective in, I think, now 27 days, not that I'm counting. And with these global records and these state records, like I'm saying, it's inevitable. We have to do something. The cost of inaction is greater than the cost of action.
Yeah, you know, I saw a study a couple of years back that pointed out, you know, we hear a lot of from the naysayers who say that, oh, it's too expensive to change our economy. We can't do away with coal-fired power plants and gasoline cars. We can't move away from that because it'll be so expensive. But this study pointed out that the cost of carbon pollution on our planet, just in terms of the direct pollution impacts, but obviously not even accounting for the massive impacts of climate crisis, is literally in the trillions of dollars. We are, all of us, paying vast amounts, much more than we'd ever pay if even if just the federal government literally got in the business of subsidizing sustainable energy and prioritizing it over carbon-based fuels, we would literally still save money if we could move in that direction. It's sort of a basic fact of economics that sort of gets lost in the discussion sometimes, is the enormous cost of carbon pollution. And we talk about not wanting to subsidize particular industries. Well, we're already, in effect, subsidizing the oil, gas, coal industry because of these tremendous cost effects.
Yeah, and then we need to think about the things that we don't normally put a dollar value on. So how much is a child's life worth, and the public health impacts that we're seeing from climate change and carbon pollution, and the low-income communities, the frontline communities, the Black and brown communities that are hit the hardest. And it's not necessarily a numbers game or a dollar game there. It's humanity. We're affecting people's livelihoods and communities that they've lived in for generations, and ignoring the fact that, like I said earlier, the people who contribute the least to the problem are the most affected by it.
Let's explore that a little bit. By that, you mean, of course, these communities tend to be people who use less electricity, probably consume less fuel, and yet they live in areas that tend to be more vulnerable to flooding and other deleterious impacts of climate change. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, or thinking about some of these island nations that are extremely prone to sea level rise and aren't using the same amount of fossil fuels that we are. Or that certain communities were put in places that were undesirable on purpose. Historically, they would flood, and now they're flooding more often.
One of the other major impacts of the climate crisis globally and here in the United States is we can only expect to see more in the way of mass migration, right? As people flee areas that are in jeopardy, they're going to be coming to the areas that are perhaps, or at least perceived to be, somewhat safer.
Yeah, it's interesting because I try to think about a place in the U.S. you can go where climate change isn't going to touch you. So I came from Oregon, and we saw big fires out there, and we always had fires, but those were like unlike anything we had seen in the recent past. I come to North Carolina, and it's very wet, and we saw 30 Atlantic tropical systems this year, and luckily, we were pretty spared in North Carolina, although we did have one direct hit and 8 remnants. But where do you go? Climate change is touching every corner of this country. In 2020, it seemed like you would open the newspaper, and it would be a different climate disaster with COVID on top of it. It was extremely overwhelming.
Talk to us about the Paris Accords a little bit more. That's something we've heard about for years. The United States was a part of it. Then the Trump administration pulled the United States out of it. Now the Biden administration is thankfully moving the United States back into that. I think at this point, maybe people have kind of lost the forest for the trees and may not even recall what's really going on with these accords and these agreements that were made internationally.
Yeah, so it's an international non-binding agreement for countries to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. So every country that signed on pledged to reduce their emissions a certain amount to reach certain targets. This was now, I think, 5 years ago. So we've now had 5 more years of inaction and 5 more years of climate change and 5 more years of fossil fuels being added to the atmosphere. And all of the countries that signed on haven't met their targets. So the fact that it's non-binding means that really it's just based on countries holding each other accountable. There's no mechanism for not meeting your target or consequences for not meeting your target. Yeah. So this is a good first step. Us signaling to the international community, we're back, the U.S. takes this seriously, we understand climate change is a problem, we're not denying climate change or climate science, but we still have so much more to do.
I saw a report recently that it appears that maybe for the first time, at least in parts of Europe, they have now moved to a point where sustainable energy is at least on par with, or perhaps producing as much, if not more, of their energy needs as old fossil fuel sources. I take it that's a direction we need to head, and we need to just accelerate that as rapidly as possible.
Yeah, and we're not building coal-fired power plants anymore. And we are increasing our renewables. And in North Carolina, we're a great state for solar. So boosting our renewable use and looking at things like incentives for electric cars and electrifying our grid are big things that we can do that will cut into that greenhouse gas emissions problem.
We're talking with Dr. Kathy Della, who's the North Carolina State Climatologist. We've got a few minutes left. I want to talk to you about 2021 and North Carolina and specifics of things we could do. I'm sure there are policy changes that our North Carolina legislature could enact that could help move us in the direction we've got to go. Are there specific things that ought to be on their agenda?
Well, I can't speak directly to the legislature's agenda, but again, going back to what I said, we know climate change is here in North Carolina, and we have to think about both sides of the coin. We're thinking about reducing our greenhouse gas emissions as part of that global community that's adding heat trapping gases to the atmosphere, but most importantly, moving North Carolinians out of harm's way or ensuring that our residents and our citizens are safe in a changing climate. So we're seeing flooding in all parts of the state. Like I said, nighttime temperatures are increasing, and that's a public health impact. So how do we mitigate some of those impacts? How do we build resilience and adaptation so that we are thriving as a state and our bottom line is doing well because we're considering climate change?
So what are kinds of specific changes we might could make that would help us to adapt? Is it about flood control? Is it about land use?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly, we don't want to build in places that we know flood, and that will probably flood more in the future. One of the things that we've learned is that many people in North Carolina don't have access to sufficient cooling. So that may be either in the daytime, during their jobs, they may work outside and you get physiologically stressed on those very hot days. I know they're very tough for me and I can't imagine working outside for 8 or 10 hours. And then at night, people may not be able to afford to run their AC or may not have cooling in their house. And our nighttime temperatures have increased dramatically, especially over the past 6 years. And if you're already stressed from a hot day, then it's really difficult for your body to cool down. We've seen heat-related morbidity across the state. And then thinking about agriculture, some of our crops need a certain amount of nighttime temperatures or chilling hours to actually develop. And we're seeing far fewer of those with the warm nights. And different pests and diseases are coming into the state that impact both people and plants. It's really everything and everybody, but like I said, at the most simple level, it's moving people out of harm's way and leaving places better than we found them.
I wonder if there's a lesson to be learned from what we've seen. We talked about how the COVID experience and the pandemic has overlapped and made this an especially challenging time. But I wonder if there's a lesson to be learned from the sort of all hands on deck approach that we've brought, in which government, pharmaceutical companies, everybody has kind of come together to tackle the COVID crisis, realizing the existential threat it poses. It seems to me perhaps that offers us a model for how we could respond to the climate emergency, that we have got to bring sort of an all hands on deck right now, urgent approach.
I have a few thoughts. I don't necessarily know that we've all come together to solve the COVID crisis. Yeah. And that worries me for climate change, because we have people who are denying facts and denying science and not following policy that is guided by truly our best available science. And then on the other front, essentially we shut down our country for March and April, and we made a dent in our greenhouse gas emissions, but not a huge one. And we've learned you cannot truly shut people in and shut down your entire economy to solve climate change. There's some positive things in there that truly, you know, if people are scared that we're going to shut down the economy to solve climate change, that truly not a solution.
Right.
But some things with our COVID response parallel climate change very closely. And there is some hope, but some of it does worry me quite a bit.
Well, we appreciate that you're there paying attention to us. Hopefully, with your work, you'll continue to get more and more North Carolinians to pay attention. They could find out more at your website, right? climate.ncsu.edu. Is that a good place to go?
Correct. And there will be a new website coming out in a few months, a new data service, and we have a wonderful blog. So sign up and subscribe and stay informed.
Thank you so much. Please keep up your vitally important work, and we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this edition of News and Views. Remember, you can check us out online and subscribe to our free newsletters at ncpolicywatch.com. For producer Clayton Henkel, it's Rob Schofield. Thanks for joining us. Please wear your mask, stay safe as best you can, and we'll talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to News and Views. A weekly look at state and policy issues is a production of North Carolina Policy Watch. Visit them online at ncpolicywatch.com.